This is Douglas Edwards, CBS News in New York, with a special report on Martin Luther King, The Aftermath. This is the day after Martin Luther King died, and the American Negro community is clearly angry, often uncontrollably angry, over his murder. In the CBS newsroom in New York, it's difficult to keep track of all the cities where sporadic violence has occurred in Negro sections since the bullet of the unknown white gunman cut down the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King in Memphis, Tennessee, yesterday. Let's begin this special report with a look at those places where the disturbances seem most severe. The CBS radio affiliate in Chicago, WBBM, reports five people dead from burns and bullet wounds in an outbreak of arson, sniping, and looting, mainly on the Negro West Side. CBS newsman Jed Duval saw the Chicago story unfold today.
It began this morning in Chicago when thousands of Negro schoolchildren failed to show up for classes, an apparent reaction to the slaying of Dr. King. And now it has come to this. The incessant and urgent chatter heard on the two-way radio of a fire engine parked in the heart of the burning and looting on Chicago's West Side. Perhaps half the fire engines in this city are out fighting fires in a 16-block area. Through the day, the children who stayed out of school roamed the large, dismal, crowded black sections of Chicago. More and more often through the early afternoon, windows of stores were broken. Police were challenged and taunted. During the evening rush hour, it became a full-blown riot. Looting reports came in one on top of another. On Warren Street, we watched a young man carrying a shopping bag stuffed with fresh meat, steaks. He stumbled, spilling the bag to the pavement, nearly at the foot of a police officer. Neither the officer nor the looter paid any attention to the other. The loot was scooped up, and the youth walked away. Restaurants and stores throughout the city closed early. Many office workers, apparently sensing trouble, went home in mid-afternoon. Shortly after dark, the olive drab of the Illinois National Guard was first seen on the streets in the riot area. 6,000 guardsmen had been alerted during the afternoon as the vandalism and looting reached alarming proportions. By the time Mayor Daley was on television appealing for calm and order, several buildings on West Madison Street were ablaze. Countless scores of stores all over the city had been looted. One factor on the side of the police is the cool weather. Chicago expects lows in the 20s tonight, and that might help. It's much colder than it will be in July. Jed Duval, CBS News, Chicago.
Police in Detroit report an 18-year-old Negro youth was shot and killed tonight while being arrested with 19 other youths for what the police describe as looting. For the general picture in Detroit, site of the worst riot in the nation's history last summer, here's Jim McQuarrie of CBS radio affiliate WJR.
Listening to police radios here in Detroit, one is jerked backward in time to the humid July days of last year when the nation's worst riot was in progress. The significant difference this time, the city police, state police, and National Guardsmen are on the job at the very beginning. Last night, Detroit, like all American cities, was too numb to act or react to news of Dr. King's death. Today, some overreaction. At mid-morning, the first violent acts were reported as small gangs of youths roamed the still riot-scarred sections of Detroit, throwing bricks, bottles, and rocks through windows. The activity was unorganized, and there were no injuries at that time. Early this morning, squads of state troopers moved into Detroit to beef up the city police. Detroit Mayor Jerome Cavanaugh declared a state of emergency this afternoon and clamped a curfew of 8 p.m. to 5 a.m. on the city. Sales of liquor and gasoline were stopped. At this hour, one accidental shooting in suburban Highland Park as police were arresting looters. There have been three non-fatal shootings, one policeman injured, and four civilians. No details are being released other than the cold statistics. Governor Romney flew into Detroit late this afternoon. Tonight, he and Mayor Cavanaugh toured Detroit, and both agreed that the preventive police and National Guard effort has been successful in buttoning down large-scale violence, at least up to this point in time. There is still the weekend to come. This is Jim McQuarrie in Detroit.
Some of the worst trouble of the day occurred in Washington, D.C., the very heart of the nation. Tonight, the White House and the Capitol are surrounded by federal troops. They were brought in on the orders of President Johnson. For a late report on the situation in Washington, we go to CBS newsman Tony Sargent.
At least 4,000 National Guard and federal troops are in this uneasy town tonight, and more stand ready. Most are equipped with M16 rifles, helmets, and gas masks. Some tanks have been brought in. 1,000 city police are on duty. In many of these streets, the troops and police are the only visible figures, but in others, looters still roam, adding to the so far uncounted number of items hauled from broken store windows in this town, starting as early as midday, as close as two blocks from the White House. At least 100 fires have been ignited. Several are burning out of control at this hour, but overall, the fires are diminishing. One just opposite me, here in the Negro part of town, is now being brought gradually under control by Washington firefighters.
Hey, how you doing? This is James Lewis. Butch, all right.
Police report having made more than 600 arrests, with over half these still in custody. Three deaths have been reported so far. Walter Washington, the mayor of this city, imposed a curfew at 5:30. As that curfew fell, thousands of motorists were choking the streets, heading toward suburban homes, weekend holidays, or just outward for the sake of it. The tourists have also been leaving in droves. Airlines report jammed ticket counters. One thing they came here for has been nipped in the bud by these riots. The annual Cherry Blossom Festival that would have climaxed this weekend has been canceled entirely. And even the opening day baseball game, originally set for Monday, now has been postponed at least one day. Tony Sargent, CBS News, in the riot area of Washington.
Memphis, Tennessee is, of course, the focal point. The past 24 hours of tragedy and the ensuing violence began there. And for a late report from the scene, here is CBS News reporter Ed Rabel.
While other American cities are seething with unrest, Memphis, the center of tension following the assassination of Dr. Martin Luther King, Jr., has thus far been spared major outbreaks of violence. There are different explanations for the lack of violence here. Police say their show of force is responsible, while Negro leaders credit their influence in the Negro community as the deciding factor. Despite all this, Memphis has had problems. Frank Holloman, the director of public safety in Memphis, made this statement earlier today.
The looting and sniping and arson activities in Memphis has tapered off. It has lessened, although there is some sporadic activities still going on at the present time.
Reports of sporadic looting and rioting are still coming in tonight, but a curfew enforced by 4,000 National Guardsmen and police tactical units is generally being obeyed, and for the most part, Memphis is calm. Ed Rabel, CBS News, Memphis.
The nation's first major riot since World War II took place in Watts, the Negro district of Los Angeles. But that area is generally quiet tonight, as we hear from CBS News correspondent Bill Stout.
One surprise in this day of anguish and turmoil was the reaction in Watts, the Negro ghetto of Los Angeles, scene of the first of the big city riots. A surprise because, so far at least, there has been virtually no trouble. Several schools were dismissed early, some before noon, and thousands of young people crowded the streets and the sidewalks and the parks, but there were no riots, no looting, no cars overturned. An incident here and there, to be sure, but nothing like the bloodbath of 3 years ago. Partly that's due to the restraint of news people and police. Unlike the riot time of 1965, this situation brought no rush of armed officers and cameramen and reporters into the middle of the ghetto. Several investigations since then, from Watts to Harlem and Newark, have produced evidence that news coverage alone can add to the trouble. But this time, the news teams held back, the police held back, and Negro leaders, militants and moderates alike, moved in to try to head off the trouble. So far, thanks to the calming elements and to the people themselves, there has been little or no trouble, though, of course, it could change in a matter of minutes. Other effects in this area, Senator Eugene McCarthy canceled the rest of his California and Oregon campaign schedule. He'll return to Washington in the morning. And looking ahead to the Oscars, the Academy Awards ceremony Monday evening, four Negro stars have canceled out: Sidney Poitier, Diane Carroll, Sammy Davis Jr., and Louis Armstrong. But all this is precautionary. So far, no violence. Bill Stout, CBS News, Los Angeles.
National Guardsmen were also on alert tonight, or states of emergency declared, in Philadelphia, in Nashville, in the state of Mississippi. The Philadelphia story at last report was only isolated vandalism and scuffling between black and white teenagers, although it's a sad commentary on the passage of Martin Luther King, to hear ourselves saying only isolated vandalism. In New York City, it's unexpectedly quiet in the Negro quarters, such as Harlem or Brooklyn's Bedford-Stuyvesant, but in the Times Square area, crowds of Negroes were reported on the street, smashing windows and looting inside them. The day after Martin Luther King was murdered started with lingering unrest in the nation's Negro ghettos. As it proceeded, there were events sufficient to keep Negro reaction at a fever pitch. Dramatically, the center of attention was still in Memphis, where King's body still lay, and where his top assistant, the Reverend Ralph Abernathy, spoke over him in a memorial service.
I am the resurrection and the life, saith the Lord. I am the resurrection and the life, saith the Lord. He that believeth in me, though he were dead, yet shall he live. And whosoever liveth and believeth in me shall never die. The Lord gave, and the Lord hath taken away. Blessed be the name of the Lord.
The Reverend Abernathy, successor to Martin Luther King at the head of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, and the crowds shuffling past King's coffin. Abernathy and the crowds followed King's coffin to the airport, where a New York newsman, Tony Brunton of WCBS, recorded Abernathy as he sought to restrain the mourning crowd.
We have pledged to you that we are going to carry his work forward. Now let us not do anything at this particular time that will discredit his life. He lived so nobly.
We shall overcome.
Go back to him.
We shall overcome.
Oh, we'll have to overcome.
Crowd moving back now, away from the, under the wing of the aircraft at the request of the Reverend Abernathy.
We shall overcome.
National Guardsmen, fixed bayonets, behind them helmeted city policemen with shotguns, submachine guns, and rifles, pushing the crowd back from time to time, asking them to move back for their own protection, as the police said. Now they have moved back at the request of the Reverend Ralph Abernathy, the man who will be taking over from Dr. King as leader of the Southern Christian Conference. He asked them to move back.
We shall overcome someday.
On the plane, chartered incidentally by New York Senator Robert Kennedy, was a grieving widow waiting to escort her husband's body back home to Atlanta. There were more keening followers at the airport, and still more at a downtown funeral parlor where the body was taken to await the funeral. It will probably be next Tuesday, with King's father, the Reverend Martin Luther King, Sr., presiding. Back in Memphis, there was still the hunt for the assassin. No one was reported in custody, but law enforcement officials were confident that someone soon would be. Confidence expressed by U.S. Attorney General Ramsey Clark, who quickly flew to Memphis from Washington to announce the full resources of the FBI were behind local and state policemen. Clark saw no evidence of a conspiracy. Police have an alarm out for one man, dark hair, medium build, between 26 and 32 years old, and, of course, white. As it was for the average citizen, this was also an upsetting day for President Johnson. There were the necessary rituals proclaiming Sunday a national day of mourning and ordering all flags on U.S. facilities down to half-staff until King is buried. But the day had deeper, more somber meanings for Mr. Johnson. CBS News White House correspondent Robert Pierpoint sums up the day from the presidential viewpoint.
Tonight from the front lawn of the White House, he could look one direction and see the dark smoke from the fires billowing overhead, another direction to the red glow of the fires themselves. From the back lawn, he could see the silent soldiers with their so far silent guns. For a president who has done more than any other in recent history for the Negro people, it was a bitter sight at the end of a dismal day. President Johnson sensed the danger last night as soon as word came of Dr. King's death, and he moved to avert it. By dawn, he had a dozen civil rights leaders moving toward the White House for a midday meeting with top administration and political leaders. The president pleaded for calm, and they agreed, but told him action was needed as well. Action long delayed to bring the Negro Americans into their full heritage. The president then announced he would speak to a joint session of Congress Monday night.
We must move with urgency and with resolve and with new energy in the Congress and in the courts and in the White House and the State House and the city halls of the nation. Wherever there is leadership, political leadership, leadership in the churches, in the homes, in the schools, in the institutions of higher learning, until we do overcome.
Late in the afternoon, after the civil rights leaders had left, President Johnson announced he had canceled his trip to Hawaii to plan Vietnam strategy. Instead, General Westmoreland is flying to Washington. Meantime, the violence and the arson and the looting worsened to the point where a saddened president was finally forced to call in federal troops to protect the nation's capital from embittered fellow Americans whom he had tried to help. Robert Pierpoint, CBS News, at the White House.
On the state level, President Johnson was emulated almost to a carbon copy by a man many insist is still a potential Republican candidate for the White House, New York Governor Nelson Rockefeller. Rockefeller appeared on statewide radio and television tonight. He officially proclaimed Sunday a state day of mourning, and he ordered flags on state facilities flown at half staff. He also announced he'd send a special message to the legislature in Albany next Monday, urging swift passage of social welfare bills, saying Americans must redeem their honor not with words, but with deeds.
There will be fighting in our streets so long as there is fighting in our hearts. Black citizens can pay no tribute to this man of peace with bricks or guns, only with courage and dignity that he proudly expected from his people. And the white citizens can pay no tribute to this man of peace merely by weeping upon his death, only by honoring, at last and in full, the principles of brotherhood for which he gave his life. I shall send to the state legislature this Monday a special message urging that such deeds quickly become law. There already is before the legislature a series of measures vitally affecting the lives of all our Negro citizens, jobs and health, housing, education and training. The enactment of these measures will give witness to our profound vow, our vow not merely to talk, but to act, so that Martin Luther King's dream of America becomes the life of America.
Robert Kennedy interrupted his campaign for the Democratic presidential nomination today, but he did keep a speaking engagement at the Civic Club in Cleveland, not to speak about politics, but instead to denounce the senseless violence that struck Martin Luther King down.
Victims of the violence are black and white, rich and poor, young and old, famous and unknown. They are, most important of all, human beings whom other human beings loved and needed. No one, no matter where he lives or what he does, can be certain who next will suffer from some senseless act of bloodshed. And yet it goes on and on and on in this country of ours. Why?
In another part of town, Cleveland's Negro mayor, Carl Stokes, was eulogizing Martin Luther King at a memorial service.
You can kill a man, but you cannot kill an idea. And the idea and the ideals for which Dr. Martin Luther King stood, for which he lived, and for which he died, will continue to live in this country, will continue to live in this city. And despite the sorrow upon, under which all of us today feel so heavy, there will on tomorrow be a resurgence. of the confidence that he was right, and that we will overcome.
Like many another public official today, Cleveland's Mayor Carl Stokes had tears visible in his eyes as he stood to eulogize the late Reverend Martin Luther King. What comes next? The main moves are probably with President Johnson when he speaks to Congress next Monday night. What will he call for? Another reporter on the CBS News White House beat, correspondent Dan Rather, has some thoughts.
What the president wants to propose to Congress Monday is a great leap forward for social justice. An open housing bill, certainly. But it is spelt here, there must be more than that. Mr. Johnson has been talking to civil rights leaders by the dozens, white and black, but mostly black, in the White House, by telephone, and through intermediaries. The black leaders have many suggestions. Most cost money, much money, and that's the hang-up. Whitney Young, director of the National Urban League, for example, has revived the idea of a domestic Marshall Plan, a huge spending program in decaying urban areas, jobs and housing on an unprecedented scale for the black poor. Caught in the fiscal vice formed by spiraling war costs on one side and skyrocketing deficits on the other, Mr. Johnson's options are few. Quick passage of the open housing bill and a stepped-up program for jobs cost the least. They are likely to get the heaviest emphasis in the Monday speech to Congress. Dan Rather, CBS News, the White House.
The wide range of reaction to Dr. King's death generally had one element in common, emotion, indicating this was one of those momentous incidents that hit most of us where we really live. Consider two statements from polar extremes. One from Jacqueline Kennedy in New York, who herself lost a husband to an assassin's bullet. The president's widow says she weeps for Mrs. King and her children and prays we'll now find more room in our hearts for love and justice. Mrs. Kennedy makes it difficult for us to sit passively in self-righteous condemnation of King's assassin when she points out, some people would never kill, but even to speak of another with hatred is the same and causes death. The former First Lady also adds, when will our country learn that to live by the sword is to perish by the sword? This in contrast to Black Power militant Stokely Carmichael, who in Washington today said, white America declared war on black America last night. As Carmichael saw it, there is no need for a lot of intellectual talk now, that's all over. We will wait, but only until we can get enough guns. What is needed now are guns and more guns. The judgment of Stokely Carmichael. The American tragedy of Martin Luther King's murder has brought an outpouring of universal reaction. Pope Paul VI urged calm and respect for the principle of brotherly love. Great Britain's Parliament expressed horror at what it termed this brutal and senseless murder. In Africa, where King was a hero, his assassination brought praise for the man from statesmen and predictions of widespread violence in America's cities. UN Secretary General U Thant, now in Geneva, sent a message of sympathy to Mrs. King. A similar message went to the bereaved widow from Sweden's King Gustav, who presented the Nobel Peace Prize to the civil rights leader back in the year 1964. Another CBS News Washington correspondent, Eric Severide, was one of those with tears in his eyes as he recorded this evaluation of that noted American, Martin Luther King.
We have all been told that we live in a bland and cautious time and are bereft of heroes. We have been told that our generation is as embarrassed in the presence of the noble as our ancestors were embarrassed in the presence of the base. The life of Martin Luther King denies the first assumption. The reaction to his death denies the second. Almost surely, he was the most important American of his time, white or black. He, more than any other man, wielded the cutting edge of history for this time and place. He preached love, so hate, of course, destroyed him, as it destroyed 2,000 years ago the man whose gospel he followed, as it destroyed 20 years ago in India the man whose strategies he adopted. Saints are usually killed by their own people. Dr. King was not. He was not an American Negro. He was a Negro American. As Dr. Abernathy once said of King, he seeks to save the nation and its soul, not just the Negro. King grasped the white man by his shoulder, forced him to turn around, and looked long and hard upon his fellow black American. To some, the sight was frightening. To many others, the landscape of our lives looked richer and full of much greater promise. There are those who proclaim that white society killed Dr. King. Democracy cannot function under such a theory. To blame everyone is to blame no one. Only the Hitlers of this world and their spiritual kin, like young Mr. Carmichael, believe in mass guilt and in genocide as justice. There are those who proclaim that this is a sick society. It is a society containing many sick individuals, white and black, including the moral invalid who fired the shot last night. It is doubtful if this nation has ever before gone into officially proclaimed mourning, its flags everywhere at half-staff, over the death of a private citizen. And this man was a descendant of slaves. This is not the reaction of a sick society, but of a fundamentally healthy society trying desperately to cleanse itself of the one chronic, persistent poison in its body. So the label on his life must not be a long day's journey into night. It must be a long night's journey into day. This is Eric Severide in Washington.
Now tonight, the vast majority of Americans, black and white, are holding their breath and hoping the poison works its way through our systems quickly and as painlessly as possible. As an outspoken voice for civil rights, Negro entertainer Sammy Davis Jr., speaking in New York to CBS News reporter Josh Darsa, was one of those urging moderation on his companions.
I plead, if there's ever been a black brother or a sister that's ever heard me and felt that maybe I had something to say, I beg them to hold their emotions in check. We cannot desecrate what this man stood for. I think that the man who goes out and loots at this point is maybe only two steps lower than the man who shot down King. The black man said to me, I am so angry with my country, I am so upset, and I want to burn down the ghetto that I live in. I can emotionally agree with that. But if he tells me I want to break down a liquor store and loot a liquor store or steal shoes, then I think we're defeating everything that this man stood for. And I think that now is the time for the militant leaders to say, all right, baby, let's hold ourselves. You're angry, you're mad, man. Let's hold it now and see if Whitey's going to come up with it.
Will Whitey come up with it, and will U.S. Negroes wait until he does? These the questions black and white Americans are asking tonight, both factions poorer, now that Martin Luther King is no longer around to help find a peaceful